Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We have a number of interesting conversations for all of us to dive into together today, and we're going to start with someone who was going to be a show a few months back when he was in Baltimore. We just couldn't get our schedules together or make it right, at least from our end, and we couldn't do it, but we have him joining us by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, author of a new book called Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Just a little background, Greg Epstein has a bachelor's degree in religion and Chinese and a master's degree in Judaic studies from Michigan and a master's degree in theological studies from Harvard Divinity School. And I've seen him described as a humanist rabbi and more, and joins us here for the hour. And Greg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good to be with you.
At last.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been looking forward to it. I had a great visit to Baltimore a few months ago.
I heard. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. This is even the title itself that you begin your book with, coming from the philosopher Seneca, where this kind of idea came from in the beginning, where most people think it is, popularized it. But before we get to that, let me begin by asking you to define humanism. And I'm going to begin by reading something from your book.
Sure.
Which is the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You dedicate it to your teacher, the Rabbi Sherwin Wein.
Yes.
Who died a couple of years back.
That's right.
And he writes, Sherwin Wein writes, "Where is my light? My light is in me. Where is my hope? My hope is in me. Where is my strength? My strength is in me and in you." So talk a bit about what this poem, Where Is My Light, says to you and what you're saying to the world about what this notion of, in some senses, well, I was going to say religious humanism, that's wrong, humanism is about.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that. And yes, the book, Good Without God, is a book about humanism. And humanism can be defined many ways, but I do define it most briefly as... No surprise, I suppose, good without God, but with the caveat that only if the emphasis of humanism, which is a sort of, it's a positive life stance for people who would otherwise define themselves as atheists and agnostics and the non-religious, secularists, etc., only if the emphasis of humanism is not just on the without God. I mean, we all have something that we don't believe in. We, you know, Christians don't believe in traditional Islam, Muslims don't believe in traditional Christianity, etc., but the emphasis of humanism is on the good. It's on living a good life, on learning how to be a good person, to build a good society for our own sake, for the sake of those we love, for the sake of all human beings, and broadly for the sake of the entire natural world that surrounds us and sustains us. So that's humanism. And this piece that you just read by my teacher, who was really one of the leading humanist thinkers of the last century, gets at this idea that humanism goes so far beyond the fact that we do reject the idea that there's a supernatural God out there that we can pray to that sets the order of our lives and gives us 614 commandments or however many that we are supposed to obey. But there's so much more to life than that. That's what we don't believe in, but what do we believe in? What is our source of light, the source of strength, the source of hope in our lives, in all of our lives, that we can use, that we can draw from to live well? And all the things that we can draw on to live well, to care about one another more, to be more compassionate, to be more mindful, to work for a more just society. Those are what I would call humanism, if they're the things that we're doing that are without God, without the supernatural.
And in just the title of your book, when you say what a million non-religious people do believe, a billion, you say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, billion.
So let's talk about where that number comes from, because you don't include in that number Hindus. You don't include in that number Buddhists or people who may believe in traditional religions of the people of the earth, the Indians or people in Africa in some areas.
Sure.
So where does a billion come from out of almost 7 billion people?
Sure. All the major religious demographic studies that have been done on world religious populations, despite different methodologies, have more or less agreed, and we're talking within plus or minus 0.1 billion, that there are about a billion people around the world today who would define themselves as non-religious or secular or atheist or agnostic or humanist. And those people are not usually considered to be part of an organized group, but my argument is that, in fact, they often have a tremendous amount in common. And what they have in common is not the God or gods that they disbelieve in, but that if you went to these people, most of whom are, just like anyone else, striving to, you know, live a good life, to pass on a better community, a better family, a better world to their children, if you went to them and you said, you know, what do you believe? What, you know, how do you believe it is that we get the strength to live a good life? How do you believe it is that we're supposed to, you know, build a better world or be a good person? They'll most likely give you answers consistent with what I describe as humanism in the book. It's that we have to draw on our own strength and the strength of others and consider each other equal in doing so, despite differences in gender, sexuality, ethnicity, religious background, etc.
And folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. His book, Finding Purpose, Compassion, and Community, Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. 410-319-8888 to enter into this dialogue in this conversation about can one live a meaningful, moral life and not believe in a higher being. 410-319-8888. As we get into this, because I know our listeners are going to want to get into this conversation with you.
Sure.
What does it mean to be a humanist chaplain at Harvard University? Then we're going to get into the meat of the book.
I work at Harvard as a chaplain for humanists, atheists, agnostics, and the non-religious. I work on a day-to-day level with graduate students, undergraduates, you know, members of the faculty, members of the local community, doing a lot of the things that you would find more traditional chaplains doing, but without a notion of traditional prayer or an afterlife or anything like that. We're focusing on helping people. And I'm really a facilitator. I'm not here to pope to anyone or to be the final arbiter of what should be good in your life, but I'm here to try to organize people to help one another, to think through together what is the best kind of life that we can possibly live for ourselves and for others. And the thing about that is, in a university context, universities today too often leave that question to religion, because a sort of secular university doesn't really feel comfortable addressing these questions of meaning, purpose, etc., in a classroom. And so they tend to say, well, you chaplains go do it. You Christian chaplains, Jewish chaplains, now we increasingly have Muslim and Buddhist and Hindu chaplains. You go and you take the responsibility for teaching students how to be better people and not just better scholars. And our view here at the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard is to say that the secular and the humanist worldview has at least as much to say about what it is to be a good person, what it is to build a good society and a good community, as those other worldviews have. And so if they're going to be represented in that prominent way in the university life, and for that matter, by the way, in the life of the armed forces or hospitals or other institutions that have chaplains, then why not humanist chaplains? And so we have a very, very active community here that people are excited to take part in.
You have one of your early in one of your early parts of the book here, you talk about the history of a lousy idea, and this is what I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. In the first century, you have Seneca, the great Roman philosopher. We mm-hmm. use this quote: "Indeed, no man can be good without the help of God."
Mm-hmm.
A, you say that's where the problem started, but B, you think that was the in the West, but B, you think that quote was taken out of context?
Yeah, basically, and people can read more about this in the book, in addition to the sort of history of the idea, but, you know, they can read a lot more about the practical applications of these kinds of ideas in today's world. But the point of that story is to say that Seneca was actually a pretty liberal philosopher. He was certainly no Jerry Falwell of the ancient world. And when he was saying no man can be good without the help of God, he was really referring to the very, very, very liberal version of God, that sort of God as the inner voice, the still small voice, you know, the conscience. And the point really of that story is that it goes way back, the notion that political leaders and social leaders have been afraid of humanism, have been afraid of the God-free version of morality, ethics, etc., that we're talking about in humanism and in the book, because religion has conveyed a certain authority to political leaders since ancient times. In other words, a political leader who was doing a lousy job for his or her people and not providing them with a just world, a just city, a just country. People were poor, people were starving, people were oppressed. That political leader could say, you know, I know I don't have much to offer you in this world, but have I got a next world for you? Have I got a heaven for you? You're going to love it. And therefore, sort of maintain the allegiance of the people, or at least get them to stop from rebelling outright. Whereas humanism simply says, and has always said since ancient times, and it goes back to the ancient East and the ancient West, it simply says, don't tell us about how nice things are going to be in the next world. We want to see a better life and a better world for everyone in this world, because we don't have any evidence that there's any life after this one. We need to take every bit of our effort, every bit of our strength, every bit of our courage and our compassion, and put it into making people's lives just that little bit better here in this world, in the here and now.
Now, one of the things that let's wrestle with a larger question here, that you wrestle with throughout the book in different ways.
Yeah.
The question is that you know, that since the beginning of the dawn of human consciousness, there's been this ubiquitous belief in God. I mean, it's mm-hmm. been with us forever. In one form or another, people believe in God. And we've killed each other over the centuries and over the millenniums over that belief in many times.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the argument is that if there is not some higher power, there is no way for us to find a way to live a moral life. Why would I not just rob a bank if I didn't believe in God? Why wouldn't I just go rape any woman I see if I wanted to fulfill my mad sexual desires? So people say rape is not sexuality, but whatever. That why wouldn't I do it if there's nothing to kind of stop me from an external force that says this is not the way one lives their life? So let's. I mean, talk about
sure.
That.
I mean, there's a couple of problematic assumptions in the points that you were just making, and I think you're making them for argument's sake, and then sort of more of a positive point that I want to make. Problematic assumption number one is that, as you said, yes, belief in gods does go back to ancient times, but one of the things that I think I argue quite forcefully in an entire chapter on the history of humanism,
yes,
in the book, is that humanism, the lack of a belief in a god, and the view that we have to have a good life without beliefs in gods and supernatural things, also goes back to the earliest ancient times. And I like to use the metaphor, you know, think about the first person, who was the first humanist? Probably one of the first few people, right? Because somebody came up with an idea that their ancestor had died and that person had gone to some sort of world afterwards, some sort of heaven, and become a god, and they passed this idea around to their family, and probably somebody in the family, whether it was the wife or the husband or the cousin or whatever, said, "Are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? What kind of a cockamamie idea is that? And you know, can we think of something a little bit more reasonable, please?" And, you know, this conversation has carried on throughout time, and we continue to have these sort of friendly debates, and I'd like to hope that they can continue to be friendly. So, yes, that's assumption number one. Assumption number two that's problematic is this idea that you can't be good without God, that people are somehow going to be pillaging and killing without a belief in God. Now, first of all, it should be obvious that the belief in God, in fact, the very, very, very strong and fervent belief in God, but all kinds of beliefs in God, have never stopped people from pillaging and robbing and committing all kinds of horrible crimes. And one doesn't need to list things like the Crusades and what have you in order to be aware of that point. And so, you know, it would be pretty sad to base one's life or worldview on the idea that, you had to have a God in order to get people to be good, when it's just, it should just be so obvious that, you can have good and bad with or without God. And I like to say, you know, my colleague in chaplaincy here at, Harvard, Peter Gomes, sometimes asked about his book, the Scandalous Gospel of Jesus, and why he chose it. I think he was asked by Colbert why, he chose to title the book that,
yes,
that way. And he said, well, because they told me I'd sell more books. And I wouldn't say that that's the title, that's the reason for the title of my book, but I would say that if we wanted a really honest title for the book, you know, we could simply say good and bad with or without God. That's really the truth of the matter. And we admit that. But that being said, there are so many positive reasons to live a good life, to do good, to feel and to act on compassion as a humanist. And the idea that I think that I really would hope people would keep in mind is that as a humanist, we may not know about a life after this world, but we know that what we are going to carry with us every single day of our lives, no matter how much we get or fail to get from the world in terms of money, fame, recognition, etc., is our conscience, is our inner voice, is our inner experience of ourselves and who we are. And if we choose to isolate ourselves, if we choose to say to ourselves, I am better than everyone else, I'm special, I don't need to listen to anyone else, I don't need to connect to anybody else, I don't need to treat other people well, I don't need to think of myself as you know, I can think of myself as better than other human beings. That choice isolates us and creates a loneliness that no matter how much we get, we can never connect with other people. This idea that we are just like other people, and therefore what we would want for ourselves is similar or the same as what other people would want for themselves. What is hateful to us is also hateful to others, is the very seed of our humanity. And so this idea of the golden rule is,
yes,
so important for humanists. And if you notice, by the way, so others besides just myself, and I talk about this in the book, that the fact that every religion has something like the golden rule in
you,
it, right?
In your book, you list the way,
exactly,
every religion talks
others,
about it.
Do unto others, etc. You know, don't do unto others that which is hateful to you. But in not one single one of these religions that has a statement like the golden rule, is there anything like God mentioned? I mean, do unto others what you'd have done to you.
Yeah,
but
in most of those religions, the assumption is that these are God's words. The assumption is not these are a human being who wrote these words and made them up. The assumption is whether you're looking at the divine interpretation from Hinduism or being told by God in Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, that these words were inspired by a higher being or told to a mortal by a higher being.
Well, so I mean, what that would imply then is here we have the lesson, right? Do unto others as you'd have done to you, or that which is hateful to you, don't do unto others. And what we're saying then is that it's a perfectly good lesson, and we don't need to include the word God in it, but we need to remind you, in case you forget, that God says you should do it. But I believe that that reminder is not always going to be helpful for people, that people will ignore something, you know, when convenient to them, that supposedly a God said, just as easily as they'll ignore something that a human said. Because if a human being really wants to behave immorally, belief in God isn't going to stop them. And I give examples of all the political leaders who've said, oh, I've sinned upon God, you know, I've sinned to you, O Lord, please forgive me. You know, as just one of many, many, many examples. But more importantly than that, I talk about this concept of human dignity and the idea that why is it that we actually have so much evidence for the fact that secular people, placed in similar circumstances to religious people, can be just as good, just as compassionate, just as moral, just as willing and able to reach out to other people and to build a better society as anyone else. And it's because there's so much reason in this world to work towards human dignity. And it really is, it goes back to this idea that if there is no life after this world, then we get no second chances. We get no do-overs. And so if you wake up in the morning and you're cruel to your spouse, to your child, to a loved one, you don't get that moment back. That's who you are. And you have to carry that with you until you improve your behavior.
Well, there's so many things I want to jump into that you said, but I've been accused by many of my listeners for not getting to them fast enough. So let me get them in the conversation. We are talking with Greg Epstein, who's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. His book is called Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And who's been holding on the longest? Robert in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stein. And also, thank you for acknowledging the fact that speakers would like to actually chime in as well. Also, thank you for having your guest as well. I forget the gentleman's name.
Greg Epstein.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein, for this conversation. You know, it's funny. I was flipping channels, and I heard you guys talk about something that I was discussing with a friend of mine a few days ago. And she had asked me, you know, what do I really believe? And I had told her, I had posited to her that I don't think I believe in God in the traditional sense that most people would expect me to believe. And she said, well, why? What do you mean? Like, what's different? And I said, well, most people believe in an omnipotent, omniscient God, you know, an all-powerful, all-knowing God, the whole nine, this huge God in the sky with a, you know, long beard, and he sees everything, knows everything, he can make it all right in the world whenever he chooses to. And I said that I choose not to believe in a God like that, because if there were such an entity that existed, I, for myself, would be disappointed. And the reason why I would be disappointed was because I would feel like, with all the atrocities and tragedies that have taken place in this world, how is it that he can pick and choose who is valuable and who is not? When he had little children and impoverished nations dying of diseases and hunger and all this kind of stuff, how is it that he can bless people in a land of abundance such as America and yet let other people kind of just go by the wayside? That's my one issue of this so-called omnipotent, omniscient God. My other issue is the fact that I believe that religion, for the most part, is nothing more than simply it's basically a huge global, you know, just universal behavioral modification program. I'm an educator, and I know as an educator, we use behavioral modification all the time. You do something good, you get coupons, which allows you to go to a prize card. You do something bad, you get a write-up, a phone call home, and so on. I think religion, all it is for me, is simply a scaled-up version of that. And I think that what happens is the fact that people, out of this fundamental need to feel like they're protected in some way, or to feel like that they are a part of something greater than themselves, we came up with this idea of religion because it is a way to kind of modify people's behavior. Because you have to understand, in the context of things, when religion first came on the scene, I'm not one to tell you when it came on, but I have to believe that the world wasn't as codified. There weren't as many laws.
Robert, only jumping in just because we have a lot of listeners backed up who want to jump in this conversation as well. Can you just finish that thought so let Greg respond?
Because at the time when religion was probably being created, the whole concept, there weren't a whole lot of laws in place to modify people's behavior. So there had to be some type of a far-reaching, overarching idea or concept to kind of make people think twice before they commit any type of atrocities and so on. Also, at the same time, hope that if they did the well, that they go to some magical place in the sky. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Robert, thanks so much.
That's great.
Greg?
A couple quick points. Number one, what is religion from a humanistic point of view, from the point of view of good without God? It's really a human creation. At the end of the day, human beings created the idea of God. They created all the major world religions. They created all the religious traditions. That's who created these things. And so just like anything else that human beings create, these things have their pluses and their minuses. I mean, that's the same. You'll find that in varying degrees for anything human beings do. We come up with some bad ideas and we come up with some good ideas. And bad ideas include, and other people have got plenty of ideas, but we know all the bad ideas about religion. So some good ideas might include the idea of a congregation or a community that comes together for mutual support. And in terms of behavioral modification, I mean, quite possibly that's part of the motivation to create religion. I would just say that from my point of view, then, ultimately, what is the best way to modify the behavior of children in a good, positive way. And it's to love them. It's to nurture them. It's to educate them and teach them to raise questions, to ask questions on their own and come up with their own answers and test those answers and to care about them here in this world as they do so. That's what I would want to teach my children. That's, I think, what most humanists want to teach their children is just, you know, we want to love them. We want to care about them. We want to teach them to treat their friends and their peers as equal to themselves and to care about others and to question everything, to keep asking questions about everything they come across and to, you know, in order to live more intelligently, you know, more thoughtfully, et cetera. That's the humanistic way of engendering, hopefully, good, healthy behavior.
I do have a bunch of questions, but I promise the listeners, let me go again. 410-319-8888. James, you're on the air. James, you there? You're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
I really do enjoy your show.
Thank you.
This is a very exciting topic. I see religion more at being a spook. It's like a scare tactic to most people. I mean, it's like you're being persuaded or more than like being scared into believing in something that really you never had seen or come ever to any terms of even knowing. I mean, you're not going to ever meet the person other than until you're gone from the earth. And who's to say that you're going to actually meet them? Is it him or her, whoever, you know? And economically, it's just a matter of a part of the whole economy. I mean, we buy into it and we, you know, sell it off, you know. But I think, you know, the world is a lot better off with religion to some point, you know, because it does keep people, you know, focused in a positive direction if you're using it in the right way. Thank you.
James, thanks so much. Greg?
Well, this question of, you know, is humanity better off with or without religion? I'm not sure if it's, you know, if it's the most urgent question simply because religion isn't going away anytime soon. And we're not, from my point of view, the focus of humanism should not be to try to eliminate religion or to eliminate religious people or et cetera. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I acknowledge in the book is that, yes, you know, you can, of course, you can be good with God. It's not that you can only be good without God. There are plenty of people who are good with God. And I want to work with those people. I want to work with them, reach out across the theological aisle, if you would, and work with them on issues like providing health care for people, on issues like addressing global warming, preventing nuclear proliferation, et cetera, et cetera. These are issues that no one group of people can solve or address alone.
But I mean, one of the issues we're facing here in terms of this discussion about atheism versus theism versus mm-hmm. spiritual belief, which you also kind of, I think, in some sense ridicule in the book, but let me come back to that mm-hmm. notion of being spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, you know, Dawkins, Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Bill Maher, and others who are clearly atheists, but they are really on the attack in some ways, even as you put it somewhere, that they are almost like fundamentalist atheists kind of attacking those who don't believe as they do.
No, I wouldn't call them fundamentalists. That's something that there were a couple of stories written.
Maybe I'm projecting.
There was one copy. there was one article that sort of misquoted me as saying that a few years ago, and a couple other articles quoted that, or the first one. I don't call these guys fundamentalists, you know, but I do think that some of the statements that some of these authors that you mentioned have made, despite the fact that many of them have some really interesting things to say, some of the statements that they've made about religion go farther than I think is helpful. You know, so Richard Dawkins may have a number of really helpful things to say, but I don't think that overall it's always helpful to characterize belief in God as a delusion, and I certainly don't think that it's helpful to compare religious education to child abuse. There are religious educators that abuse children, but I think the crime that they're guilty of is not religion, but abuse. Parents are always going to want to educate their children. You know, Sam Harris says science must destroy religion in one of his articles. Bill Maher says, "For humanity to live, religion must die." These are not the most helpful statements. These are, by and large, intelligent people with interesting messages who, at certain points, go a little bit farther than I think is helpful. And I'm trying to bring us back around to a different message, one that says, look, we're trying to focus on what non-religious people do believe. We're trying to remind people that there are millions of their neighbors out there, maybe a billion of their neighbors around the world, who are not traditionally religious, but are just as interested as anyone else as they are in building a better world, in building a world that is more compassionate, that is more just. And can we all work together? Because at the end of the day, with the problems that we face in this world, global warming, proliferation of weapons, etc., we're either going to be a round table where we sit around together and try to solve human problems as equals, or we're going to be a circular firing squad.
We have to take a very short break. And when we return, we will reopen the phones here, 410-319-8888. Gabriel and DeConte and others who are holding on, we're going to get to your calls in just a moment as we talk to Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain of Harvard University. The book is Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. And we'll remind you right now that WEAA is calling on you. We're looking for volunteers for this show and others, WEAA programs, during the upcoming April-Spring membership drive. If you have a few hours to volunteer, please call our membership department at 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking with Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain of Harvard University, author of the book Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Remind you as we get back to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Number here is 410-319-8888. Going to go right to the phones here in just a minute. I want to get you all back in this conversation. But let me, a couple of things I wanted to raise here very quickly. I mean, I think that it's a very fine line, it seems, that people walk here when they have different beliefs in where we come from. And I mean, you talk a great deal in the book about all the kind of different ideas that we might have and we all strive for and look for. And in many ways, whether you're a theist or an atheist, that we look for the same things, which is trying to, you have the great series of conversations you're about is love all that all we is love all we need. Mm-hmm. But then you go on to talk about striving for dignity, striving to live the Ten Commandments in a way that is not necessarily a religious way, but still there. Mm-hmm. You talk about the need to build community and culture. You talk about the idea of finding human dignity and finding a way of life, living by the golden rule. So let's talk a minute about those things, because you're doing it in a non-religious way. So talk about what sets it all apart.
Well, I mean, I think that most of human life is not a response to this question, is there a God or not? Do you believe in God or not? Because for most people, even in America today, who even do believe in God, I'm not even sure that they do believe in a God who, answers their prayers. And I mean, the statistics will tell you one thing, but the people that I talk to, often believe in some kind of God, but it's not really a God that's at the center of their moral lives, unless times are tough, and then maybe they'll turn in prayer. But I try to focus most of my life. I'll just say this: I try to focus most of my life not on this question and the endless debate, is there a God, isn't there a God, but on what do I need to do to live a good life? And the concept of dignity to me is central. This question of what is my purpose in life? I respond in the book to Rick Warren, who I've read quite a bit of.
Right.
I've enjoyed reading, and he's an author of a book that is billed on the cover as the best-selling hardcover nonfiction work of all time. The purpose-driven life. By the way, I mean that billing and the advertising doesn't that seem to imply that the Bible is fiction? But I digress. His book's message is that it's not about you. That life isn't about you. That if you're sitting around complaining about all these terrible things that happen to you and why me and why can't I get more of what I want, et cetera. Well, it's not about you. Get out of yourself and realize that life is best lived for the purpose of something bigger than you, higher than you. And all that's very true. But then he goes on to say that the only purpose worth living for, appropriate to live for, is Jesus Christ's purpose. And a very traditional version of Jesus Christ's purpose is that. And if you live for anything other than that, then you will be damned to hell for all of eternity. And he says it in a very nice and friendly way, but unfortunately that's the message. And with that, as a humanist, you can imagine that I disagree. And I think that there are many, many wonderful ways of framing a life for yourself, of understanding life as being for a higher purpose, without saying that that higher purpose has to have anything to do with gods or magic or miracles or heaven. I mean, the saying that I like, that comes from traditional religion, but once again has nothing to do with God, is, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? And that, to me, is the definition of a life of dignity. It's this idea that dignity doesn't mean being a doormat. It doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to be so generous that anybody can do whatever they want to me, and I'm not going to care because I'm just going to take care of them. No, we have to take care of ourselves, but we can't limit ourselves to that. That's a very lonely, selfish, isolating life. We have to do for others, and for not just the ones that we love, but for also for other people in the 21st century. It's no longer enough to just say, I'm going to take care of mine and to hell with everyone else. And so that's very important. And that's dignity.
We're talking with Greg Epstein, Good Without God. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. Let me go back to the phones for a few callers in between my own thoughts. Gabriel in Columbia, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Gabriel.
Hi. I'm just calling to first say thanks for actually having this discussion. I think it's long overdue and well needed. Also, I'm also going to thank Greg Epstein for the book. I actually met him in December with the Secular Student Alliance at UMBC. So,
oh, hey there.
Yes.
Oh, you guys are great. They have one of the, these guys have one of the best groups of secular students in the country. I was very impressed with Gabriel and his group.
And it also inspired me to start up a meetup group for African American Humanist Society. And a way to give a voice to a community that I feel that is often overlooked. I remember one of the hurtful things that I've seen is D.L. Hughley on his talk show once said that I'd never heard of a black atheist. And I was shocked because I said, well, have you ever heard of Frederick Douglass or A. Philip Randolph or some of the other, you know what I mean, prominent African-Americans that have shaped this country? And I feel that African-Americans have or humanists or atheists have such a small voice that they really need a group that will come together and actually share the humanist belief without having being so tied into the supernatural. And part of the book is really what inspired me to have a group like that.
That's interesting. Which, as yours, in preparation for the show, one of the things I did was kind of look at the history of free thinkers, atheists, humanists in the African American community historically. And just for our listeners, let me read you a list of some of the people I found, just because what you were saying, Gabriel. You said A. Philip Randolph. We just did a program on Hubert Henry Harrison, who is known as the Black Socrates, George Schuyler, John Henrik Clark, James Forman, who was one of our civil rights leaders, Lorraine Hansberry, Butterfly McQueen, who famously said before she died in 1990, as my ancestors are free from slavery, I am free from the slavery of religion. Charlie Parker, W.E.B. Du Bois, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker. I could go on, but I won't. But so, I mean, there's a body of people that we don't even think about who were free thinkers from the black world who were and are.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Gabriel. One last thought, then we'll go to another caller.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have one other thing to say?
Oh, yeah. No, I just wanted to say thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you, Gabriel, for calling. And let's go to Chris in Towson. You're next.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Chris. Welcome.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate mm-hmm. it. I wanted to ask Mr. Epstein a question. I was wondering if what his views were on an afterlife.
Well, we just don't have any evidence for it. I just don't see any reliable evidence for any life beyond this world. And I think that we can't absolutely rule it out. But the point is that anyone who's going to tell me about their vision of an afterlife as informed by their traditional religion, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, etc., I'm profoundly skeptical about whatever information the clerics, the clergy, the religious authorities from any of those religions have to offer me. You know, why should I listen to that one person versus any other? Because they all have competing claims about what the afterlife is supposed to be. But more importantly, I would say, although we don't have evidence to disprove, you can't disprove a negative, right? You can't prove that anything doesn't exist. So everything could exist, right? But what are the chances that it exists? And what counter evidence do we have? So I would say that we've got a really great body of evidence to suggest that the afterlife is a concept that human beings created, as the other caller said, to try to modify behavior. So every single religion has some kind of concept of an afterlife, whether it's Christianity and heaven. Judaism has a resurrection of the dead that we don't usually talk about that much these days because a lot of Jews have become very secular and they're not interested in this sort of thing anymore, but Judaism very much has the concept. Buddhism has nirvana, right? The idea that we'll go to a perfect place where we'll stop having desire, and many Buddhists before that have a concept of a pure land or a heaven. Hinduism has reincarnation into better and worse lives. Well, why is all of that? It's because for most people throughout most of history, life has been about suffering. Or in other words, to put it more scholarly, more academically, life has sucked for most people for most of the time throughout history. And religious leaders have tried to tell them, if you follow my path, it will be better for you in the next life. I can't promise you anything in this world, but support me, maybe give me some money, maybe, you know, follow my commandments, and it will be better for you in the next world. So that's where I think the concept of the afterlife came from.
Gotcha. I guess the reason why I asked is because you were talking a lot about doing good instead of bad and everything, and I guess my question to you is how would you define good and bad? Because those afterlives you were talking about with Hinduism versus Christianity and everything, like, because good and bad in this life can be different, because in Hinduism, the concept of helping the poor and that sort of thing does not go with that religion, because their idea is that you're in that caste system and that's where you belong. It seems to me that in Islam, that pretty much the same thing. It seems to me that only the Christian religion is the one that says to look out for the poor, to look out for the less fortunate, and that sort of thing. So I think what you're doing, sir, is that you're taking the essence of the religion, but trying to take the God who mandated it away from that.
No, what I think I'm doing is trying to respond to human needs and to create a system to be part of a tradition that has worked for thousands of years. And because I do argue that the humanist tradition really has its roots in the same ancient world that all of the major world's religious traditions have. It goes back that far. I'm trying to be part of a tradition that makes life the best life that it can be for people here in this world. And if that means that some aspect of some religion got something right, then I'm going to adopt it. And if some aspect of some religion is wrong, then I'm going to reject it. That's what I'm doing. And I'll say, you know, religions, you know, all religions have their strengths and their weaknesses from my point of view. And you know, Christianity does have some wonderful language and tradition about helping the poor. However, if you look at societies that are predominantly Christian, I would ask, are the poor really helped often in these societies, or are the poor just as rejected, just as shunned aside as they are in many other societies? And I think we really have to reckon with that question.
What about those in, and then I'll go back to at least three callers in a row here before the end of the hour, because Clarence has been holding on, DeConte and Kevin in Mays Chapel. I want to get to them and the others. But the question of when you look about talk about Spinoza, who kind of didn't believe, we won't get into the whole Spinoza thing, but he clearly didn't believe in a supreme being and a God, but felt that God was, as you write, universe itself, that encompassed everything.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who have, which you seem to also kind of say is not real, which is a spiritual belief, whether it's a kind of Jungian belief in a mass consciousness or in a sense of a spiritual belief that is not about a supreme being, which is something different than what you're talking about.
Well, all right. You brought up a couple points. One is Spinoza, and the other is this idea of a spiritual belief that's not tied to a traditional religion. Now, Spinoza said that he believed in God as the universe. All right.
Right.
But this was not a universe that could be sort of magically prayed to, or that could, you know, respond to human needs. This was not. Spinoza didn't believe in the sort of God that some quote-unquote spiritual people believe in, which is the idea that, oh, everything happens for a reason, right? He didn't, you know, this is not his idea. And by the way, everything does not happen for a reason. We need to let that go. And that's the kind of quote-unquote spirituality that I do have some issues with, because I think that it oversimplifies life and it sets people up to have expectations that are not realistic, and that therefore end up hurting people. But you know, Spinoza was looking for language to express what people in the modern world have figured out, which is that that human beings created religion, we created the biblical text, and that the world is really the process, part of a process of natural selection, of natural evolution. That's what Spinoza believed in. He sort of was looking at the physical laws of the universe, and he called them by the name God, but he wasn't interested in praying to that God. And the people who expelled him from the Jewish community as a heretic and as an atheist knew that. He said, oh, I believe in God. They said, yeah, sure, get out of here. You're a heretic, you're an atheist, you're a non-believer, because they knew what he really believed. And again, in terms of spirituality, I think that we need to be able to have a profound sense of gratitude for our lives, for this infinitesimal chance that allowed us to be present here in this world, for the fact that we are star stuff, as Carl Sagan said, we're made of the same material that stars are made of, and that we're all connected that way. And it's that, if you want to call that spiritual, I think humanists are profoundly spiritual. But you don't need to use the word spiritual for that. And I just think that what we need to avoid is believing in things for which we have no evidence.
We're talking to Greg Epstein. Let's go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888, Harvard humanist chaplain, author of the book we're talking about this evening, Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Clarence, you've been holding on forever. A quick thought. Sorry to make you wait so long.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Very quickly. I'm from the school of thought of Dr. Margaret Atwater and Robert Campbell. She so eloquently put it, it's which story do you like, the story where you have something after this life or the story where there is nothing? I believe in order for us to live a better life, we have to make the connect back to the nature of things. Materialism is the enemy of humanity, point blank. That's it. When you make the spiritual connection back to the nature of life and understand that the operative word in this thing is life and not materialism, then we can start, at least from that point, to live a better life. Also, as Dr. Campbell, in one of his documentaries, had the Indians, Indian chief speaking, he said, life is a spider web. We are all part of that web. No one can disconnect from it. They didn't even understand the concept of selling land or anything, you know. Also, I had my spiritual awakening. That's why religion doesn't play an active part in my life. I'm happiest when I can walk out amongst the grass and the trees and say, thank you for this wonderful gift of life, because that's the operative word. That's the operative word in this whole thing, life, not Where would we be if we did not have corporate entities and monies driving us away from the things that I just described? That's the starting point.
Well, let me let Greg respond real fast.
There were a number of points just made, but I would just say that the most important thing to me to keep in mind is humanists believe in life before death. that you know, you can put it on your bumper sticker if you choose to, but really think about it. We believe in life before death, that if we're going to die and we don't know what's coming after that, and we know that we can't rely on some traditional religion to give us an easy answer to what's going to come after we die, and most likely all the evidence to me suggests that is the end of our existence, then it makes every moment in this world count. And I talk about the fact that you know, a father can tell his son, I love you, one more time, and make a profound difference, you know, even on his deathbed, as I think about my own father on his deathbed, that you can reach out to someone you love. You can reach out and do something good in this world in every moment that you have. And that our lives and the significance of them is ultimately that's the sum total of what we do or fail to do. And that's what I hope people really take from humanism. That's what I hope our message really is. It's not against God. It's not against religion. It's a profoundly positive statement that let's go out together and build something positive for all human beings. And I was really taken, by the way, by Gabriel's comment. I think that's the greatest compliment that an author like myself can get, that he went out and he created a group for African-American humanists. And I talk about African-American humanism in my book. I talk also about how humanists and non-religious people should go out and try to build organizations and institutions. The American Humanist Association's national offices are not far from you guys in Baltimore. They're in Washington, D.C. And there are all kinds of ways for people in your area to get involved in humanism. And if you read the book, you'll get a lot of suggestions how to get involved.
We have one last quick caller here, and let me go. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we don't have much time. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I was just kind of wanted to say that I founded the Greater Baltimore Atheist Community specifically as a way to counter the idea that you can't be good without God. That's one of the most popular slanders that religious people give to me all the time when they find out I'm an atheist. So, you know, we're kind of allied, me and Mr. Epstein there are kind of allied in our quest. We organized through a website called meetup.com if anybody's interested, and we're going to have a meeting this Thursday down in Columbia. So check us out if you want.
All right, Kevin, thanks so much. And I should, a caller called in, I should do this as well, remind folks that a correction from one of the earlier callers that when they said Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam don't care for the poor, I mean, that's just, it was incorrect that they do. In the religion, spend a lot of time caring for the poor, and I didn't want to leave that out there hanging like that either.
I mean, I think all peoples and all traditions have a tradition of caring for the poor.
Greg, I'm sorry, but we are really out of time. But from the numbers of callers we have in this conversation, we could do this for 2 hours.
Sure.
And we want to have you back to continue this conversation.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And again, you know, this day and age, if you say we can't be good without God, that's not your opinion. It's a prejudice. The book is about how to live in a good way without God, how to be a humanist.
Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard University. The book, Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
It's been great. Folks, we're going to take a very brief break. I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state, the number is 1-800-492-5538. We'll be right back.